and welcome. Before I start with my own work, I'd like to read a poem by Patrick Kavanagh, if I may, because I like the sound of the name in it. Because it reminds me from what it reminds me about where I'm from. Shankledus. My black hills have never seen the sun rising. Eternally they look north towards Armagh. Lot's wife would not be salt if she had been incurious as my black hills that are happy when dawn whitens Lough Drummond Chapel. My hills hoard the bright shones of March while the sun searches in every pocket. They are my Alps, and I have climbed the Matterhorn with a sheaf of hay for three perishing calves in the field under the big fort of Rock Savage. The sleety winds fondle the rushy beards of Shankledus, while the cattle drovers sheltering in the Fethemna bush look up and say, who owns them hungry hills that the water hen and snipe must have forsaken? A poet? And by heavens, he must be poor. I hear, and is my heart not badly shaken? And so to my own work, sorry that. This first one I usually start readings with. It's almost like an invocation. It's called Roosters. It's a tale of potatoes. And I read it in memory of my grandmother. My granny used to soak the spuds too, making it easy to peel them later. Part of morning's ritual was topping their pot with water. Later, after fowl were fed and tea and bread were ate, she peeled them slowly, humming all the while a medley of Moore's Almanac songs. Steeping my potatoes now, as she did, brings her four green fields down the years to me. Scaly and red, these roosters, instead of her soft queens, mine tackle of modern machinery, long scars that I smooth away with a stainless peeler. I split them with a long, broad knife, rinse them down, and leave them by for dinner. And now I turn to a poem that I wrote, supposedly, for my husband. My mother supposedly for my husband. My mother used to say that the way to a man's heart is through his stomach. The garden of earthly delights. In the kitchen, Valentine, it will begin with the green curlicues of garlic shoots hid in the coal shelf of the fridge. The prying, bulging eyes of spuds will wake in the clammy closeness of their plastic bag, all being pulled spring tight tonight through the tilting built into the bolting seed husk. And you too will respond with the flick in your loins, the click in your head as my hands riot in the radishes, tease out the aubergine chunks, toss together pillows of cherry tomatoes, and delight in these firm ruins of last year's seed pods. There, Valentine, is where you will begin. Think of this bit in my own way, by my own look. Music is a big thing in our family. It sort of bypassed me, but that's it's more through lack of opportunity. My father is a great piano player, and it seems to have come down to Gwyn, my middle son. And one composer whose music I like rather a lot is Debussy. Debussy trapping notes from Nightingale. On the lines of a page, Claude transposes the collective melody. Some are remnants sounded together from daily life, caught on horizontal lines. His bars track on, right across the white page, peppered with black-bodied birds that sit tight, caged on the wires. When they take flight from the broad-spread hands at the piano, his skills shape their timbre and shadow. He reads sunlight, wind, and rain within their soaring, beyond that dead page. And at the close, those sleek bodies alight again, gripping to the lines with their twig-like claws, eyelids shining within the confines of the page, roosting with the breeze until the next time. Alice's boudoir. I watched you at your dressing table through the looking glass. Your left hand lifted the silver-handled brush, and you began to sing as you brushed down the ears. I longed to copy you, look through your eyes. Carefully, you softly brushed dark tresses, coyly eyeing yourself as dim light encroached. You only ever turned your back on me once, when you gently placed the brush back in the coffin at the end of the bed. I'll turn to some of your work. At the end of February, myself and my husband were very lucky to steal a weekend away from the children. Not an easy task, because it's the case of having to put two here and two there and so on. And we went to Rome. Mm-hmm. And we only had 3 days there, and we wanted to try and pack in as much as possible. We made the unfortunate mistake of wanting to go and see the Sistine Chapel on the Saturday afternoon, which of course they close early because they're getting ready for the ceremonies on Sunday. This poem came 3 months later in June when I was sitting on the beach, cloud watching. I'm not seeing inside the Sistine Chapel. You were a sky gazer, a cloud watcher, seeing within those steamed puff pillows the forms of fabulous beings. Just now, I saw a fisherman, his white head turned away, his finger flung behind him, pointing at infinity. His rag-rolled head streamed to the west, clothes rippling in the high sky wind. And when my lazy eye looked again, he morphed into a huge ornamental eel whose top lintel was a crocodile's mouth, snapping at the blue. This too bleeds, feeds into a sterling pound sign. You must have spent afternoons on your back, gazing at patterns forming and merging, dissipating where the mind dragged it. You took your pigments and pulled them, your art fixing a borderless sky inside a broad high vault, peopling the heavens. Ah, Michelangelo, I know why the sky became your backdrop, why you love shades from azurite to smalt to cobalt blue. This afternoon I got a really rare gift given to me. Paul took me down to Kinsale and I met the poet Desmond O'Grady. And to say that I was in awe would be a complete understatement. And it put me in mind of this poem. This poem is called Old Head Kinsale, and it kind of it had a weird coming about. I wrote the poem long before I ever came down to Cork or even knew about Kinsale or indeed the lighthouse down there. I had no title for it. And I was down here last December and I went down, saw the lighthouse and went, yeah, that's it. That's the title for the poem. Old Head Kinsale. Fixed high on a greasy cliff above a western sea, heavy lidded, a copper globe bound a cobalt iris, speckled with hazels. The eye languidly closed, reopened slowly. Focus fixed on a sky traced only with stray contrails soaked in a bleeding sunset. The eye gazed, as though to penetrate the outer confines of the dimming atmosphere, hunting for the evening star. The dark pool's pupils barely grew as the sun lingered in the west. Soon the sea would consume the light entirely, and then the eye could watch. Now this next poem is about two of my children, the twins, and it's sort of the story about how they came to be named. It's called Slashing Out the Mist. You were nearly Nemen and Maka for a while, as I reversed into the idea of two, not one. I turned to books to see how to deal with motherhood again. Born in the hothouse of Gemini, dire at first, head down, ready for the bullseye. Small, dark, but sturdy like an oak, quiet he emerged. Just like I imagined the stoic owner of that brown bull that set off all of Ulla's woes with Maeve's mad quest for bestering. A double crown whirling his wet hair up and around to copies of his father's eyes, an indulgence within the handhold of a soft skull. Emer's back still cuddled under my ribs. The registrar produced her like a gift to warm applause from sisters, nurses, students, just like Cuchulainn's darling, already fluent in the crooking of others to a finger's curl. A smaller purse of red lips, eyes that curved in echo of her brother's, but slighter by just 4 ounces. You both slept, doubly wise, swinging in the plastic crib, two small buddhas responding blindly to each other's touches. Two poems about my own childhood memory. Both these poems come from a workshop that Matthew Sweeney did last year on The Guardian online. There's a poet who does a workshop every month, and they kind of do different challenges. It's worth kind of looking in to see what's going on. And his particular challenge, he put up 10 lines from W.F. Graham's poem, first lines, and the idea was, because we wouldn't be familiar with the work, you could go anywhere with it. So the first line for this one was, I have my yellow boots on to walk. And it became Feeding the Cat. I have on my yellow boots to walk beside your greater green ones. Our feet splodge across the mud mouth of the shed gate, where the calves tread muck and straw into an earthen brown popped with their cloven prints. Even the rain has given up this winter. The insistent chill invades my red anorak. We have wind from the north, you mutter. That means snow and more blessed misery. You pour the calf nuts into the clang of the metal feeder. The smell of warm tea oozes from the calves' steaming breath as they nudge their heads through the bars, warm in themselves. Now this second one is the dairy shed, and the first line was, whatever you've come here to get. Whatever you've come here to get is forgotten at the fly screen door slammed shut behind you. The squat barrel of a disused butter churn calls you to peer inside. One-eyed, you spy the spider's home and retreat. You pick up old butter paddles with long grooves, pretend them gripping a pat, shaping creamy yellow fresh air into buttercup dollops. The dresser's top shelf draws your gaze to long-necked blue bottles that gawk at the story on a glazed cracked willow place. Below, a small bottle of clear pottery for rubbing fire into newborn calves. You remember now the yellow cornmeal. From the yawning Hessian sack, you snatch a handful into a bowl with boiled potato skins, the secret ingredient of the hen's deep golden yolks. Now I have a slight change of direction. Earlier this year I wrote a series of sonnets. Oh no, not sonnets. George Mallory was a climber who died on Mount Everest. He had gone up in 1924. It was the third expedition that the British had sent to try and conquer the summit. They hadn't recovered the body until actually in 1999. An expedition went up and they found the body. His body face down, one leg crossed over the other. One leg is broken, a length of rope stretching from his frayed, so that told its own story. But the back of him was certainly weathered with frost and what have you, but underneath his clothes were still perfectly preserved. He was wearing old-fashioned alpine clothing. The layers, the climbers of the 99 expedition, could not believe how thin the clothing that they wore. But they retrieved from his pockets some personal items, and I used those items as the basis for a series of sonnets that sort of tried to tell his story. The first was rope. Just a short length of frayed, cut-off rope. He cut me out one day, knee bent at an edge, my feathers flaring from the twine of threads. Or maybe later in the house of Toke canvas, shielding him and Irvine, their hopes waning, building with each day's fresh snow dredge. That's how I've ended up here. A small wedge, a splice unpicked from history, one wee grope away from notes and letters on that climb, concealed in his pocket until the rime cools us all down flat to the mountain, hard as marble, a cold bite freezing the damp of fabric, drying it, conserving his cramp, compressed into waiting out time's old guard. And the second one. They found lists and letters. You'd think these things would be left at home, in a quiet wooden drawer, in a desk with wooden cubbies, a leather blotter, and the reassuring ratchet of slats sliding home as the roll top lid wound down. But here they are, these bills, lists, and letters, scraps of paper, clues as to your intent, camps in Roman numerals, provisions from the least grain of sugar and dark tea to the numbers on the gauges of metal bottles that you've become so enamored of. Thin air robbing each breath of any scrap of strength. Amongst all those papers, they did not find your picture of the one you'd left behind. From the series Goggles. I was the one who volunteered this earlier. You can blame me. As Norton lay in an imposed tent night, sleeping sacks draped over to make it dark, was your grim, steady courage a small spark that stoked his snow blindness to a greater white, or made it seem that you could reach that height, the one where he had meant to try his mark? With summer valve, just beyond the rope's arc, when sense prevailed above 28,000 feet, neither man admitted whose infirmity was the end. Damning proof, if proof were needed, how far Englishmen kept their privations for their own journals. One thing you did make sure of for your friend, Silver's goggles in your pocket, discerning. Now, here's another one from the Roman weekend, called, funnily enough, Roman Holiday. In the swimming pool blue of their room, they butterfly towards each other through beads of heat, the glaze produced by two moving bodies. Cars rollick by outside the louvered windows, ruffling the cobbles, as he scopes far above him, scrying for an answer in a smog-bound spring sky. She leaves sand behind her. Inhale, exhale, the exchange of air hastens the clutch of warm flesh. Autumn watches from the wall, head tilted, eyes slitted, lips parted, just so. Since autumn made an appearance in that last poem, and it is autumn time, here is autumn herself. She leaves notes on the brambles, glistening blackberry globes for stewing for dessert, or damsons ready for eager children hands to scrump. She's the crush of burnt sienna velvet in a dress fondled in a department store. She's low-angled sunshine across a field of beige barley stubble. Her scent is the must of late saucer mushrooms. Her jewellery, scarlet berries, hiding in the deep green prickles of the holly tree. She flirts with a passerby in the blaze she leaves on a 10-year-old beach, her fire going quickly over to bronze. They cling until the first hard storm spins their dry crunches into a limp mess and down the muddy street drain. Now, just two more. Thanks for being so patient. I'm giving this a road test today, given the current economic climate. It's called When the Rat Race is Run. Mm-hmm. There's never enough time to look and feel as good as the catalogue guys and girls with their flat abs, light spilling from their sides, shadows that should not be physically possible, airbrushed by the drab click of a mouse dragged over that depression, this man, so that overall Batman lives but without the grab. Mm-hmm. She's stuck in a queue in Argos, spellbound by the slabs of plastic gilt in her unclasped purse, keys to the kingdom of credit handed down from the crunch junkies, the world's worst curse of limits with upper limits that keep on extending until sometime in the future when a red letter bursts through her letterbox, the full force distending the window, the envelope's window, the carrot long asked by the donkey, no sounds for her crew-cut ostrich head bending to escape the sliding smackdown of credit entropies. Now, and this is my last one. Alan Gillen, his latest collection is Hawks and Doves, and in that collection there's a poem called The Lad, which is about the male member. I read this poem and went, what that poem needs is an answer. His poem is set in a bar. So is mine. And it's called Where the Laugh Works. The talk in the bar dizzies the half-time fill as I knife scrape the head from another pint. He hovers, pocket filtering his change. Readying for the ask, he addresses my full frontals, my baby buggy bumpers, my Brad Pitts, my boulders, my jingles, my squashy cushions, my soft-focused bristles, my motherly bosoms, my matronly book, my Mickey and Minnie, my Monica Lewinsky, my Isaac Newton, my snow tires, my speed bumps, my Tweedle twins, my milk makers, my Mobutus, my num nums, my Piazadoras, my push mataharas, my honkers, my hooters, my hubcaps, my hummers, my Eartha Kitts, my Eisenhowers, my God's milk bottles, my Picasso cubes, my chasticles, my cha-cha, my coconuts, my dairy pillows, my devil's dumplings, my objectified orbs, my uber boobs, my one part Lara, two parts globe, my skyward pits, my lift and separate, my airbags, my feeders, my mammy glands, my Bob and Ray, my big bouncing Buddhas, my sweater stretchers, my sweet potatoes, my rosaceous roasters, my trusty rivets, my melliferous melons, my mau-mas, my tarty, my tot, my pertapalookas, my jahubis, my kicking kawangas, my agravic gobstoppers, my immodest maids, my Scooby snacks, my squished in shlow. My cupcakes, my soda fars, my bloomin' bats, my brilliant bangers, my brash bazookas, my windscreen wipers, my Winnebagos, my wop babaloobop bop babaloos, my yahoos, my yazoos, my yipping yin yangs, my pats, my pips, my pommes de terre, my pushed up, plunged down, paraded balcony, my slow reveal, my instant appeal, my decolletage, my fool's mirage. And I watch him pay up, steady up, and leave.